two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
I saw the new Mr. Rogers movie recently. You also remember what movies are, right? And there was a sentence in it that struck me, and it's one that I think is probably known to many of you. And he says, when I was a boy and I saw scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. And then that movie, after I heard that line, it made me realize that what I want to be, all I want to be, is a helper. All of my time being an entrepreneur, a public servant, a business person, leading the healthcare.gov turnaround, a founder of a major nonprofit, an investor in underserved communities. That's my dog. I realized what I was really aspiring for, and that's just to be a helper. I think we need that in this time. I don't care who you are. And I want to be helped too. I want to be helped by going through all this together, because there's no monopoly on getting through tough times. So I hope that this podcast does serve that purpose in some form.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Wachter. You just heard a voice that should be very familiar to frequent listeners of this show. I hope you haven't forgotten. That's Andy Slavitt. And that was Andy on the very first episode of In the Bubble, which was on April 1st, 2020. And yet another one-year anniversary, but one that's pretty meaningful for all of us here on the show. So we thought we'd start out with a little clip of Andy to remember those early days. And to mark that, I'm beginning today's episode with a brief chat with the person whose idea it was for this podcast. That wasn't Andy. That was Andy's son, Zach Slavitt, who is now finishing his freshman year at the University of Pennsylvania, which happens to be Andy's alma mater and my alma mater. So it's a good time to check in with Zach and see how his year has gone and reflect on the origins of the show. So we've got a few things we want to talk about with you, and thanks for coming on. First of all, I understand, as I heard the history of this podcast, that this was your idea.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, true or not true? And second of all, if true, what made you come up with that idea?
Okay, well, yeah, it is true. I don't know. Like, I had the idea for my dad to do a podcast, like, a while before, and then, like, I don't know, he started, like, kind of blowing up a little bit beginning of the pandemic. And so I was just like, okay, like, you should do this because a lot of people do this and people your age listen to podcasts.
assuming their hearing still works. That's what they do. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just thought it'd be a good opportunity. Like, he can get good guests. Honestly, like, initially did not intend to, like, be involved at all. But I don't know. That just kind of happened as well.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
What was his reaction when you suggested it?
He was just kind of like, oh, like, cool idea. Initially, and then, like, eventually, I don't know what happened, but then eventually he was, like, into it, like, sent out a couple emails and just, like, I don't know, set it up, talked to Lemonada.
And did it come out the way you had hoped it would?
Yeah, I think so. Honestly, like, I didn't know anything about podcasts, like, going in, and I didn't know, like, how successful or not successful it would be, but I just think, like, the fact that so many people liked it a lot and there's cool guests on, like I personally learned a lot. So I don't know. I think it was definitely a success.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I was a big fan before Andy called me and said, how would you like to do it? You know, a lot of the listeners got to know you before you left for school. So tell us how your first year at school has been.
First year's been, I don't know, it's been fun. I think other people have probably had more challenging years than me, definitely. So I don't know, I can't complain about anything, even though obviously it'll be a lot more fun normally. And I think, I don't know, like academically, it's like a little challenging doing stuff online, like hard to stay focused and stuff.
Yeah.
And participate in class and everything. But I don't know, it's getting better, I think, too. Like, I think more and more fun things are going to start happening, like with the weather changing too. It's gotten warmer out, so people have been doing stuff outside. I don't know, it's just going to keep getting better, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. What's been the experience in terms of classes? Has it been all virtual the whole year, or was it ever in person?
No, yeah, it's been all virtual. A lot of them are asynchronous too, and I don't know, it's just like definitely easy to fall behind and stuff. Like a lot of people are falling behind. Like I've tried to stay on top of most things. But it's just like with all the asynchronous lectures and then like you miss a couple and then they all add up and then you're like way behind.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy to happen.
And what's been the kind of social and cultural experience? That's obviously one of the big things that happens as a freshman, and obviously it's been different. So how's that all worked out for you?
Well, yeah, it hasn't been like impossible, like meeting people or anything, just cause like, I don't know, especially when it's warmer out, we can do stuff. But obviously like trying to be safe and everything and balancing all that can be a little challenging. Especially like when I hear older guys talking about like what they would do in a normal year, like, oh, like this weekend we would have had this big event, but we can't this year. I don't know. That's like a little frustrating, but it hasn't been too bad, honestly.
Yeah. What's the thing that you're missing most or looking forward to most as things get back toward normal?
I'm probably looking forward to going to like big concerts, like music festivals, stuff like just like huge, massive things that like you obviously can't do right now, especially like with like famous like musicians and stuff, like, I don't know, stuff like that with friends and everything. A lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm a little worried that you're going to name one of those famous musicians and I've never heard of that person. In fact, I'm almost 100% sure. Like, you're not talking about, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Billy Joel and James Taylor, right?
No, definitely not.
Have you heard of those people?
Oh, yeah, I've heard of them. I would not listen.
Makes me feel better. Yeah. No, of course not. But it might hurt your ears.
And your favorites?
Those are my, yeah, I'd say Springsteen, Billy Joel, James Taylor. You know, the problem is, I think there is nobody that I listen to that I did not listen to in college, which is really disgusting.
Okay. That's probably going to be me, honestly. Like, I don't know. I'll probably be the same way with like the current music now.
Yeah. Still, it just happens. You sort of can't believe that it would happen because it feels like your parents, but you turn into your parents. It's very weird. Yeah. How about, are you looking forward to the sports games?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if those Penn sports games are too exciting. Well, from what I've heard, but I don't know. It'll be good to go to at least some sports games, maybe some Sixers games.
Is Penn still playing the Palestra, or they've moved?
No, yeah, they still are.
Oh, it's great. You know, even though the teams aren't great, it's just when it's your team, it's pretty cool.
That is true. Yeah. And like, I don't know, the fact that one team from the Ivies goes to the tournament every year is kind of exciting.
Yeah, usually for one game, but
yeah.
So Zach, is there anything you want to say to your dad now that it's been a year of COVID and he's had these amazing roles, both doing the podcast and now what he's doing in the White House?
Yeah, just that like we're all like so proud of like all the work he's done in the last year, like so busy, like not getting any sleep, and just I don't know, doing everything he can to try and make the whole situation better. So it's just like a great job.
That was wonderful, and he deserves it. I know how hard that is. I'm trying to think what my kids would have done if asked to say that about me. But he actually truly deserves it. He's a remarkable guy, and you're a great kid. I'm glad things are going okay for you. And yeah, next year will be better and a more regular college experience, and I think you'll love it.
Thank you. And yeah, good job on the podcast.
Thanks. Appreciate that. See, that's easy to say when I'm not your dad, right?
Wasn't so bad. Thank you.
Well, a special thanks to Zach, not only for spending some time with us, but for coming up with the idea of this show, which I know has been so meaningful for so many people. And I'm glad things are going reasonably well for him, although it's gotta hurt. I think back on my freshman year and some of the very human experiences as you were breaking out of the shell of living with your family. And obviously that's been a very different experience for Zach and all of the freshmen out there. And it sounds like it's getting better and it will continue to get better. So I wish him and all finishing freshmen just a fantastic and exciting sophomore year. Well, as long as we're on the topic of education, we thought it would be interesting to look at how this year of COVID has transformed medical education. We've spent a lot of time talking about elementary school and middle and high school education, a fair amount of time about the colleges, not so much talking about medical education. And medical education has been transformed perhaps more than any of those other fields because it wraps up not only education and all the issues of trying to keep people safe and moving a lot of the education to online, but also the issue of actually taking care of COVID patients and trying to figure out how to do that effectively and safely. So we decided to look at medical education and its transformation through the eyes of three different people, get three different perspectives. One, that of a medical student just entering her clinical rotations. The way medical school works is first year or so is classroom, and after about a year and a half, you begin going into the hospital and the clinic seeing real patients. We also looked at it through the eyes of a resident who was making a transition from the intern year, which is mostly about getting the work done, to this very special role of being a second-year resident where you take on much, much greater responsibility, not only for delivering the care and supervising the care of some very sick patients, but also for teaching and supervising interns and medical students. And finally, we thought it'd be useful having the perspective of a leader in medical education, someone who has had to reorganize her educational programs on a dime and also to make sure the trainees were safe and that the institutions that depend on them to deliver clinical care could continue to do so for both COVID and non-COVID patients. To find these three people, I decided to look pretty close to home at my own institution, UCSF. In one case, I chose to look very close to home, and that was with the medical student who is my daughter, Zoe Lyon, who in March of 2020 was just beginning the third year of medical school at UCSF. And I can tell you for the past 10 years or so, she's been really looking forward to going to medical school, but particularly to that moment where you leave the classroom and actually begin taking care of real-life patients. So she was about a month into that when COVID hit, and this incredibly formative year was transformed. We'll also hear from Jack Penner. Jack was a second-year resident at UCSF. Again, this extraordinarily formative year. And Jack will talk about how this changed the nature of residency training. And for a leader in medical education, I didn't have to look far for that either. Catherine Lucy is our dean for medical education at UCSF, and she is truly a national leader in thinking about innovation in the training of physicians and has been a leader at multiple institutions and a national leader in that. And so I really wanted to hear her perspective on how the year has gone. So we will begin with a conversation with Zoe and Jack, and then bring on Catherine toward the end. Let us start with Zoe and Jack. So, Zoe, I'm not sure everybody understands how medical school works. So tell us about where you were in your studies when COVID first hit.
So when COVID first hit, I was in the first third of my clerkship year. So I was on clinical rotations, which happens for UCSF students after their first year and a half in school. So we've technically only been in school for a year and a half, but then we become third year students and we leave the classroom and enter the hospital and start rotating. So when COVID hit, I had finished 1.5 full rotations.
So your first year and a half really is being in classrooms, not that different than what it might have been in college. You're learning new stuff. And then it really toggles into something very different where you're going into hospitals and going to clinic and seeing real patients.
Yeah. So it's basically you go from learning in a classroom to essentially working every day and really kind of doing the thing that you thought you were going to come to med school to do.
So you've been waiting for however many years you wanted to be a doctor, and here you are, and you're about to start doing the real patient care thing, get out of the books, get out of the internet, and really take care of patients. And maybe it sounds like a month or two into that, this hits. When you heard about it, did you kind of have a sense of how disrupted it, how your education would be? Or did you think it was kind of going to be a month or two of maybe it'll be a little different, then I'll get back to normal?
Definitely the latter. I could not have imagined how disruptive it was going to be, and not disruptive necessarily in a bad way, just disruptive in a change way. I thought maybe things would be a little bit different for 2 weeks, maybe a week or so, because that's what the school initially told us. And mm-hmm. then 16 weeks later, we had a plan.
Yeah.
So no, I don't think I could have imagined at the beginning how different it would be. It was not the year that I was expecting, but there were some wonderful, meaningful surprises that came out of it.
So let's just talk for a second about what you did. So, okay, you're supposed to be going into the hospital and taking care of real patients and talking to them and examining them and mm-hmm. being on a team. And let's say after the first week or two of everybody not having any idea what to do, they figure out a plan. And I know they did because I kept paying tuition. What was the plan that you had? What did you actually do for your education, given that you're no longer going to be doing the clinical rotations you expected to do?
Yeah, so basically, so I left the hospital on Friday afternoon, and then San Francisco shut down, essentially. And that Sunday, we got an email from the school saying, no, third-year students should return to clerkships on Monday. We had a series of meetings with all the education deans, I think that week. And then they basically said, sit tight, we're coming up with a plan rapidly, and we'll let you know. And essentially what ended up happening is that we stayed out of the hospital, I guess, for 16 full weeks. And what we did was we did all of the didactic components of our clerkship year. So UCSF kind of interweaves classroom didactics with the clinical learning in the clerkship year. And so we did all of that up front. We took all of our shelf exams in a 16-week period, which was a really...
What's a shelf exam?
A shelf exam is a kind of comprehensive examination that you take at the end of each clerkship that tests your medical knowledge for the clerkship. So like you do them for psychiatry, surgery, internal medicine, OB-GYN, pediatrics, neurology. And then we did one for family medicine as well. So we essentially had 3 week blocks of learning for each of those different rotations. And then we had like self-directed study time. I think actually Jack was, he was like a small group leader for me when I was doing my internal medicine didactic component, which was great. And so we did all of this upfront kind of classroom learning that we would have done in a longitudinal fashion, had the year not been disrupted by COVID. And then we did these shelf exams, the kind of clinical knowledge learning portion, in a very compressed time period.
What was your sense about the degradation of learning? In other words, how important is it to actually see real patients? I assume what you did with Jack and others was read about cases, hear about scenarios of patient comes in a short of breath and has a fever. So how important is it to actually see real people?
I would say vitally, vitally important. I think that it was really such a mindset shift going from being in the hospital one day and kind of flexing those muscles and interviewing real patients and seeing things in real life to then going back to the classroom. I had to really, like, honestly dig very deep to find a lot of meaning in that, just because the clinical, having gone from the clinical experience and then being taken out of it, it was really sad. Mm-hmm. There's really no substitute for seeing patients in person. You know, I can do a million questions about, you know, hyponatremia, but then actually seeing a patient who's actually manifesting those symptoms, like, that's what really sticks with you. I think you and Jack can probably both speak to that experience. So it was a really big shift, I think. And then going back to the hospital after we had done this kind of very compressed didactic learning, while they were figuring out how to restructure our year, I was then just reminded that there is no substitute for seeing patients in person and really doing the daily work and understanding what it means to be a physician.
Yeah, I think people probably have a hard time understanding. It's not just seeing an actual person and examining an actual person. There's a rhythm to the way that the hospital and a clinic work and what everybody does and who does what, that you just can't get out of a textbook, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even, you know, being a clerkship student, like a third-year medical student is hard at baseline. It's oftentimes like, okay, like, where am I going to put my body in this situation? Like, am I standing in the way of the resident? Or, you know, am I, like, taking up too much space here? Or, like, how do I do this in the EHR? And, like, the learning curve for those things is so steep. And so I think, and that's the stuff that just takes time. And so losing all of that time or having that time restructured, I think that was what was hardest, was then jumping back in and then having to kind of restart that learning curve again.
Got it. So I'm going to do a little translation. So hyponatremia earlier was a low sodium level, and EHR is the electronic health record. That's a computer that we use. It's one of the things that happens that when someone goes from layperson to being a doctor is they start speaking a different language. It's hard to remember kind of what the normal language was. You mentioned that there were parts of it that were really hard and challenging and depressing, and then there were parts of it that somehow were positive. What were the positives?
So I had a really cool opportunity to take on essentially a COVID-related project while we were figuring out how the year was going to proceed. And so I was really involved with this project at San Francisco General, setting up like iPad visits for patients who couldn't have visitors to the hospital due to visitor restrictions. And I was actually in the hospital multiple times per week, essentially running this service where we would take iPads into patients' room and then visit with the families over Zoom. And it was extremely gratifying to be able to connect with patients in that way and just be back in the clinical environment and also build something from the ground up that seemed really meaningful for patients and for providers, because I think there was a lot of strain on doctors and nurses and everybody who couldn't say, yes, your family can come to the bedside. And so people were really grateful for our service. I think San Francisco General themselves, they were really grateful. It was cool to kind of like redeploy ourselves in that way, since we couldn't actually participate in care for patients, we could contribute in this way.
Any particular scenarios or stories that you recall from that that was really meaningful or poignant?
Yeah. So there were a few Zoom calls where we actually facilitated basically end of life goodbyes for patients whose families couldn't come, because this was even before you could have one person come for end of life. And so without going into like kind of too much emotion about it, it was extremely poignant and profound and difficult to have to see that happen over Zoom. Yeah. I think at one point my therapist told me that I was acting as a death doula, which I thought was odd, but appropriate. But those were the most meaningful things, I think, were being able to have people say goodbye to their loved ones.
Yeah, it's hard for, if you haven't had a family member or someone who's been in the hospital and very sick, and particularly this issue that they're heading toward the end of life, and the idea of trying to do that without your family member being allowed to be at your bedside, it's just brutal. And the idea that you were able to ease that somewhat through the iPads is really, that's pretty profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Let us turn to Jack. So Zoe kind of described the life course of a medical student. Jack, you already went through that, and then you became this thing called an intern and then a resident. And so describe what that is and then what stage you were at when COVID hit.
Yeah, so I was in the second half of my second year of internal medicine residency. So I had gone from being a fourth year medical student to then being able to sort of move from this middle phase where you're both a student and a worker on the different services in the hospital to being primarily a worker where my training was also a part of my work itself. And so in the intern year, you move from being a fourth year medical student to a first year resident. And during that time, you're really sort of learning via immersive work in the practice of a physician. And so for me, as an internal medicine physician, it was a mixture of working on inpatient hospital services, as well as working in the clinic. And then after your intern year, where you're really learning by primarily being the person who's doing the work, you get to transition into the second year of resident, where you take on a new role of still doing the work itself, but then also supervising other learners who are also doing the work. And so as a second year resident, I was supervising interns. I was also supervising medical students, but at the same time being supervised by an attending physician who was sort of, I would say, ushering me through this next phase of training throughout the second 2 years of internal medicine residency. So I was about halfway through residency training overall and maybe 8 months or so into that second year of residency.
Okay. And so you hear about these cases happening in China and in Italy, and it's clear that it's coming, and you're in San Francisco, and it's probably going to come in a big way. For Zoe, it transformed it as in, you know, she changed from a real second or third year to Zoom University. For you, I assume we did not boot you out of the hospital. You stayed at work. So what was that like?
So much of learning in residency and practicing in residency is driven by the structure of the services that you're on, but also this sort of informal, passive learning and practice that happens just by means of being in the hospital. And I think because that environment changed so much in terms of what types of social interactions you're able to have in the hospital, the opportunities to get to interact with your colleagues and your supervisors, just like in the hallways of hospitals and in the workrooms, I think that felt like a tangible shift right away. And then, of course, there was also the fact that many of the hospital services were restructured in a way where there was now the ICU team and a COVID ICU team. There was the inpatient medical service and then the inpatient medical service that was taking care of COVID patients because we were trying to cohort them together. For me, early on, that meant that some of our clinic time changed a lot because all of a sudden we weren't necessarily going into the clinic itself, but doing virtual clinic. And then also having had the opportunity to be a part of caring for patients in the intensive care unit with COVID during the early parts of the pandemic. I think those were both really rich and new opportunities. And also the changes I think made being a resident feel a lot different. And I think in ways that are ultimately hard to quantify, but a lot of that sort of social fabric of training really felt like it degraded necessarily to keep us all safe.
You're young. I assume that you know, the data would say, even if you got COVID, you're probably going to do okay. But nevertheless, you were being exposed to a whole lot of patients with COVID. How scared were you?
It varied from low-level anxiety to moments of feeling true fear. And I think as time went on, the anxiety predominated over the fear. But I can remember in March having potential exposures to patients who had upper respiratory symptoms, and we just didn't know. And some of the testing algorithms weren't in place yet to get answers right away. And so it was taking days. And I think, you know, it was a bit surprising because I feel like our whole job in some ways is learning how to manage and navigate uncertainty. And when that uncertainty feels like it's directly impacting you, it felt a lot different. And so there was definitely moments early on of feeling fear at what might happen to me, or God forbid, I live with a partner who doesn't work in medicine, and God forbid, I exposed her unnecessarily or potentially got someone close to me sick who wouldn't otherwise have been exposed. And so I think it slowly settled into a low level anxiety about it. But even that anxiety, I definitely has felt tangible in different ways throughout the better part of the last year.
Have you any of your colleagues get sick from work exposures?
I have had one close co-resident who did contract COVID while we were working together in the COVID ICU.
Zoe, one of the sort of life stages you were at was needing to figure out what you wanted to do for a living. Mm-hmm. People think, well, I've decided that I'm going to be a doctor, but that's about 500 choices you need to make once you've decided you wanted to be a doctor. So has this experience influenced that at all?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it was hard. It was hard having kind of such an abrupt stop after doing 1.5 rotations because I had done my entire surgery rotation and half of my psychiatry rotation. And so for a while, I kind of thought I wanted to be a general surgeon because that's all that I knew really in terms of the day-to-day other than my exposures to other parts of medicine prior to my third year. But I went on kind of like a windy road coming back into the hospital after we were out and circled back to internal medicine, which is what I came into med school thinking that I wanted to do. And I was also interested in critical care before COVID, and then COVID only made me more interested in critical care. So I'm grateful for that. It allowed me to have a lot of exposure to how dynamic of a field it is. And I've been able to work on some COVID research and connect with people who are very, who are working in the space really closely. And I think that those are opportunities that might not have opened up otherwise. But there are also things that I feel like, you know, I spent like 8 days on a neurology service total. And so I kind of have no idea, like maybe I was supposed to be a neurologist. It just like wasn't enough time.
And Jack, people are going to find this really weird. So you think, all right, I've chosen to be a doctor. Now I've got to make a choice. And the choice is internal medicine versus surgery versus neurology. You chose internal medicine. You still have a ton of choices ahead of you. So how did this experience influence your choice? Because you could then do all the subspecialties of internal medicine, cardiology, oncology, et cetera, primary care, hospital medicine, administration, epidemiology, sort of, you know, it's still pretty wide open field. So how did you think about that change?
Early on when COVID was happening and there was lots of changes happening to the residency structure, there was a chunk of time where I had clinic, but I didn't really have that many patients to see. I wasn't working in the hospital during sort of that phase of residency training. And I simply had a lot of time to kind of sit and reflect and do some self-directed learning and and a lot of reflection. And I think for me, I think that time in the spring retrospectively was really important to kind of have the space in residency to ask myself, what are the things that I really enjoy about my own training? What are the things that I really want to continue to do? And I think getting to be on the front lines throughout the pandemic has reinforced a desire to really be a primary provider and a primary provider within the hospital setting. And so for me, I kind of started the pandemic thinking about a career in infectious diseases and have come out the other side as much as we are now wanting to pursue a career as in general inpatient medicine, specifically in the hospital setting. I know that for many people, infectious disease clinicians really became superheroes, and it's probably one of the things that is going to be incredibly popular for the specialty. But for me, it did create a bit of a pause and some really valuable time to reflect during residency training, which we really didn't get to have, or I should say, which we don't oftentimes get to have. And I think that space and time to reflect helped me realize where a lot of joy for me came clinically. And I think hospital medicine has ended up being the space that I settled on there.
Great. Yeah, we did a show last week about the lessons from HIV/AIDS for COVID, and those were my formative years, basically the same stage that you guys are at. And Carlos Del Rio from Emory was on, and he talked about how he was sure he wanted to be a cardiologist, and then AIDS hit, and that's how he decided to do infectious disease. So whether it's gravitating toward the specialty itself or just giving you a chance to think about it in a slightly different way, you know, a lot of people make different choices. I understand medical school applications are up. Are you surprised by that? Either one of you? Zoe, are you surprised by that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this is the best job ever. No, I don't think that's surprising. I think, you know, if there's any, there's still so much like romance in this profession, I think, and it was only further, that was further amplified, I think, throughout the pandemic.
Jack, are you surprised that it's made the field apparently more attractive for now?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I'm really happy to see that. That's a new stat to me. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've noticed from sort of consuming a tremendous amount of popular culture content over the course of the pandemic is that I think for a long time, a lot of what I feel like was talked about medical school was you're going to go to medical school, you're going to be in a ton of debt, you're going to work really hard, and a lot of physicians burn out. And I think there was, because of physician voices becoming more and more prominent throughout the pandemic. It did, I think, expose the general public to a lot of the pain and tragedy and hardship that physicians saw during the pandemic and that families of patients who had COVID also saw. And I think the opportunity for those stories to be shared. And my hope is that it added a new layer of meaning to the type of work that we get to do, meaning that I know that I have felt throughout medical school and residency training, but that was always hard to communicate. You know, there's perspective pieces in medical journals, and those aren't always read by people who might be considering a career in medicine. And I think so much of the humanity of this practice, it seems like, has been able to be disseminated to the general public now. And yes, like, it has been really hard and really emotionally challenging throughout the last year to sit with grieving families and to see patients dying alone. And there has been a huge opportunity to infuse meaning into that. And I hope that people who are considering a career in medicine are able to see that, because it has been really hard and an unforgettable time in training for me so far. And so, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's right. I'd add that it's also the most interesting thing you can imagine. I've always felt, now 40 years later, that it's a privilege. And having lived through the early years of HIV and AIDS, you know, it's hard and it's disruptive, but you will look back on this, I'm not sure fondly, but you will realize how profoundly it's changed you and the many things that you've learned from it. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. It's been fascinating. And thanks for all the great work you've done over the past year.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I didn't do any great work, but thank you.
I saw you on Zoom. I saw you doing some really great Zoom work.
Some great Zoom work. Thanks.
Welcome to the Dough, where Cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between. Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, a special thanks to Zoe Lyon and Jack Penner. Really interesting and in many cases quite moving. I had a chance to watch Zoe up close and personal go through the year. And the challenges of trying to learn online and realize what you're missing. But also, I was extremely impressed by the medical students at UCSF and how they really felt the need to contribute in different ways if they couldn't be there taking care of patients. The residents did an amazing job just rolling up their sleeves and learning to do this work, this incredibly important work, in very, very new ways. And I'm on clinical service now, and I come into the hospital, and as Jack talks about this, the change in kind of the sociology and the culture of the place, that's very real. My team is in one conference room with four people, and they sit there all day. They go out and see the patients and then come back, and it's this room, and in the next room is another group of four or five residents and students and attendings, and we have about 10 of them scattered around the hospital, whereas in normal times, they would all be sitting in one big communal room, a lot of sharing, a lot of learning, a lot of laughing, a lot of commiserating, and that has really been broken up for, obviously, for really, really good reasons, but I think it was useful hearing from them and looking forward to things getting back to normal for them as well. So now let's get the perspective of a medical educator and medical school dean and administrator and bring on Catherine Lucy. For this episode, I spoke to a medical student, Zoe Lahan, and a resident in medicine, Jack Penner. We talked about their experiences over the past year. Why don't you tell us about your experiences over the past year? Tell us about the early days when you heard about China or maybe Italy or maybe the cruise ship, kind of, and you had a sense this was going to change things in some ways. Did you have any sense it would change things as much as it did and that it would last as long as it did?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, people keep using the word unprecedented in terms of the COVID pandemic, and certainly it was unprecedented in terms of scale and scope and disruption in every sort of organization you can imagine. But it really isn't unpredictable. I mean, Bob, you and I were physicians in the HIV pandemic, and there have been lots of other pandemics and crises that have impacted medical education in the time that I've been a physician. And so when we started seeing things, particularly Italy, I think was really what began to make us very anxious, because we realized that if the United States was going to be subject to as much disruption as Italy did, we would really have to fundamentally change the way we conduct medical education for a lot of different reasons, for scarcity of PPE and scarcity of faculty, all the way to concerns about risk. An inappropriate risk, perhaps, for early learners in medical education. So we began to sort of mobilize and think about how are we going to make decisions in a very dynamic environment. But I don't think we were really as creative or as we might have been in imagining what type of disruptions were going to be in store for us.
In the clinical environment, telemedicine felt like the biggest pivot. You know, we went from 1% or 2% telemedicine to 70% telemedicine, and probably did 10 years of innovation and transformation in a month. How important was that in the educational environment, and how does that change your thinking about the environment as COVID recedes, hopefully into the rearview mirror?
Yeah, I was very impressed with that, and that's another sort of COVID. I think benefit from COVID. You know, I laugh a little bit because I think maybe a full decade ago, the state of California invested in telehealth opportunities, and they just didn't catch on, with the exception of our colleagues in neurology and pediatrics, I think, have been kind of leaders in telehealth. It was helpful in education. It wasn't a predominant strategy in education because, honestly, the faculty needed some time themselves to get used to what telehealth looked like before they had to simultaneously engage in telehealth and teach a medical student how to do telehealth. So we were really conscious of faculty bandwidth and wanted to give them a little bit of time for that. But eventually, students were actively participating in telehealth. And many of the early students helped, for example, seniors who were not technology comfortable by preparing them. So they found different opportunities to serve the community, for example, by helping seniors set up their telehealth appointments and preparing them to work with the doctors that way. It certainly is affecting medical education going forward because we have to prepare the students to be able to deliver care in person and online. And I think that there are some really wonderful patient-centered philosophies we can do. You know, you can really meet the patients where they are and minimize their burden of getting to the doctor. And I think that'd be really positive. At the same time, we have to teach students to recognize and residents to recognize when does an individual need to come in for an exam? What can you do in terms of an exam over the teleconference? Those are pretty advanced skills, but I think beginning to introduce them into the medical education environment is going to be an important part of subsequent work. Starting now and then following the pandemic.
We've talked a lot about how COVID changed the past year in terms of medical education and how it may lead to some changes in the future, but the year was also characterized by all of the issues around racial justice. How did the layering of that on top of COVID influence your approach this year, and how do you think it changes things going forward?
I think that the issues, the health consequences of structural racism and our responsibility to prepare not only physicians who use their professional competencies in the office, but use their cognitive abilities and backgrounds to be really effective citizens that right social wrongs. And some of them will do that as advocates and some just by voting in the elections and advocating for particular political approaches is really going to be pivotal to our success going forward if we want to meet the needs of our communities. We've been working on issues of equity in education and teaching students about healthcare disparities for several years now. But I do think this last year kind of put the pedal to the gas, and I think appropriately so. You know, institutions, academic healthcare institutions, medical schools, colleges, they're built for inertia in many ways. And I think the COVID pandemic and the racial justice reckoning really have catalyzed work that has been proceeding, but proceeding at a pace that's inappropriately slow. When we think about the lessons of COVID in the year 2020 and the year 2020, preparing our learners to not only be pandemic ready, but to be able to identify, address, and prevent healthcare disparities in the future are going to be guiding principles that we use going forward. In many ways, a major disruption allows you the freedom to innovate in a lot of areas, not just ones that seem to be obvious, and the pandemic has been the case for that. So I'm excited about this. I think our learners are farther ahead than many of our faculty, but together I'm confident that we can build a better workforce that not only is better prepared for the next pandemic, but hopefully has already addressed the issues of structural racism that are embedded within our institutions and interfere with us providing the right care for all of the patients that we serve.
Great. Maybe last question. As you mentioned, you and I trained during the early years of HIV. And now as we look back on that training experience, it probably changed us in ways that we didn't understand at the time. As you reflect back on that and, you know, how maybe 10 years ago, how long ago was that? Maybe 10, 15 years ago?
Why? Yeah, something like that.
What do you think today's trainees will think as they look back on this year of COVID?
I think they're going to look back and first of all, they're going to be the types of individuals who understand that legacy practices are legacy practices. And if there's a reason to change something, we should change it. And I think we found that in the HIV pandemic, you know, when sometimes you deliver care in a specific way because it's always been that way. And oftentimes it's a pandemic that disrupts that and requires you to think differently about it. So I think they'll be empowered to think about changing legacy practices. Secondly, I think they will look back on this the same way we did in the HIV pandemic about how critical it is to work across the medical professions and across disciplines to solve complex problems on behalf of society. You know, physicians can't work effectively without pharmacists and nurses and techs and respiratory therapists and environmental services people. And we can't solve problems with just science that's done under a hood. We need community advocates. We need sociologists, psychologists, epidemiologists. And so the need for broad expertise in multiple disciplines, I think, will be embedded in these students forever. And I think the third thing, you know, much as we learn to advocate for marginalized populations that were, you know, disproportionately impacted by HIV, I think the students will see this as a real reckoning and the responsibility of looking deeply into working with communities of color and people who have been historically marginalized by medicine and responding to their needs and with their expertise, changing the system so that we better serve those communities. So that came out of the HIV pandemic, I think, and marked your career and my career. And, you know, that epidemic spawned a lot of leaders of American medicine. And I hope this pandemic will be similarly impactful in that way.
Yeah, I almost no doubt that it will. It's inevitable. And as I've told, you know, students and residents, this is changing in ways that are hard to understand in real time.
Yes.
And no one will wish this on anyone. But in the end, it has some positive effects and certainly sensitizes people to the plight of patients and the needs of the system to work in very different ways. So, Catherine, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Bob. It was great. I appreciate your invitation.
Well, a great big thanks to Catherine, Zoe, and Jack. I think you now have a good picture of what it was like to be in the medical educational system this year and some of the hardships, some of the poignancy, some of the tragedy but also some of the innovation, as Catherine said, institutions like this, and I think medical education is probably no different than any other professional education, and maybe not all that different than colleges and universities, but they don't innovate that easily. They're big battleships. They're kind of hard to turn around. And sometimes crises like this provide the opportunity to rethink things that you probably should have been rethinking all along, but you just don't. And I think some of the changes that will come out of COVID will turn out to be quite positive. I am very much looking forward to seeing that. Well, we have some more great episodes coming up here on In the Bubble. Another UCSF colleague, Monica Gandhi, who's an infectious disease and HIV specialist, who's become very well known nationally in some of her writing and her social media and the regular media, for advocating for a bit more optimism and a bit less glumness in our approach to COVID, particularly as it comes to vaccines. She thinks that we have been overemphasizing the downside, the variants, all of the bummer stuff, and not celebrating enough what miracles these vaccines are and some of the things that people, she believes, can and should begin doing safely. And the day we spoke was a particularly interesting day because it was the day that CDC Director Rochelle Walensky described her feeling of, quote, impending doom. So we'll have an interesting talk with Monica about that and how to sort of where the needle should go between optimism and pessimism, particularly in this time where vaccines are rolling out very fast. Cases are coming down in many parts of the country. In San Francisco, there's just a handful of cases a day. In London, as Monica will point out, there was not a single death today. And yet we see upticks in cases in parts of Europe and in some states in the United States. So it's a little head spinning to try to figure out where one should land in terms of optimism and pessimism. But I think Monica has become really an interesting and useful spokesperson as we try to calibrate our own mood. We'll also talk to Rhea Boyd. Rhea has been a national leader in thinking about the impact of COVID on communities of color, particularly the Black community, and a spokesperson for some of those really important issues, particularly with the layering of COVID and issues of racial justice. And the issue of what to do about the kids remains as resonant as ever. And it's not only about the schools, but now it's about summer camps. It's about travel, and if I'm vaccinated, can I bring the kids? As usual, 100 complicated issues around the kids. So we will bring back Paul Offit, who's very well known as a vaccine expert, but is also a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he'll be joined by a to-be-named child psychologist, and that will be a toolkit. So we'll look forward to fielding your questions about what about the kids. So until then, stay safe, get vaccinated as soon as you can, and I look forward to talking with you soon. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McGowan produced our show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuryev. Jessica Cordova-Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax executive produced the show. Our theme was composed by Dan Molad and Oliver Hill, and additional music by Ivan Kuryev. You can find out more about our show on social media at In the Bubble Pod. Until next time, stay safe and stay sane. Thanks so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere? And suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time. Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Feminasty Erin Gibson.
And I'm homosensual Brian Safi.
And we're the co-hosts of the Attitudes Podcast,
where we talk about LGBT plus issues, gender issues, and pop culture.
Probably with much less respect than they deserve.
Look, it's a wild world, and we want to help you laugh at it. Plus, we discuss everything going on in our lives.
Like, what do you do when your husband accidentally starts a fire in a dumpster?
And the best armpit slapping techniques to get rid of the bags under your eyes. Thanks for the advice, Mom.
And of course, how to spin a wig around to achieve a brand new look.
Stunning. So if you're a fan of high heel shoe chairs or have a crippling fear of hot air balloons but also believe in social justice, then this show's for you.
Listen to Attitudes anywhere you get your podcasts.